Purple Heart.
Nice left.
Those weapons of mass destruction gotta be somewhere.
By 2014, the war in Afghanistan will be over.
Nice left.
Well, you know, general is not necessarily a general.
No weapons over there.
He may be a communist. Nice left.
Welcome, everybody, to Eyes Left. This is your host, Mike Preisner. I have to start off today with some bad news, but also some good news. The bad news being that your host, Spencer Appone, is not joining us on today's episode. This is a tragic first for Eyes Left. Spencer will not be here to take us to the metaphysical realm or to offer his many other great insights, since he is deep in the end of a graduate school semester, and we decided together that we would rather let me take the reins of an episode rather than go the entire month without new content for our listeners. But please wait before you switch off the show now, because we all know, and I am more than happy to acknowledge, that Spencer is the best part of this podcast, and it is very hard to imagine it without him. Let me offer you some good news before you decide whether or not to listen. I have for you, as an offering, as an alternative, another Spencer, a Spencer named Spencer Ackerman, who has just written a very, very important article documenting the state of the VA long-term care facilities and the utter despair that veterans there are enduring, with a really tragic failure of VA leaders to properly respond to the COVID pandemic. Really important and timely story here. We also had a very interesting discussion about his new book titled Reign of Terror, How the 9/11 Era Destabilized America and Produced Trump, which is due to be published in early spring. Spencer is the senior national security correspondent at The Daily Beast and, in my opinion, doing very, very admirable work there. And he's also a winner of the Pulitzer Prize for Public Service Journalism, part of the team at The Guardian, awarded for covering Edward Snowden's revelations in 2014. You can find him on Twitter at Attackerman. But that is not all. Spencer has, for a long time, very long time, since the early years of the Iraq War, been reporting on U.S. wars, not simply from the comfort of the United States, but in the heat of them, both in Iraq and Afghanistan, as he explained to begin our interview.
I went to Iraq the first time in January 2006 and went back in March of 2007. That time was embedded. And I went to Afghanistan in September of 2008 on an embed, and then went back in, August of 2010. And each time I was there for about a month. So I was in Iraqi Kurdistan. I was for not very long at all in 2006 in Kirkuk, because my fixer informed me that we had to get out of there because of, you know, people noting that a young white guy in a white Toyota Corolla was driving around. Was in later Baghdad, in Mosul, in a place I had never heard of before in Afghanistan called Zormat, in Kabul, was in Bagram, around, you know, Parwan province a bunch when I couldn't find anyone else to take me on an embed. So that was sort of a quick, you know, tour of my very limited experience in Iraq and Afghanistan.
Wow. And what kind of units were you embedded with?
It spanned the gamut. When I did embeds in Iraq, I was with MPs for a while. In Baghdad, I was with, forgetting the acronym, but it was, was it a PRT, like a provisional reconstruction team that was like, you know, a fig leaf of a civilian effort, but was primarily military and lived on what was then FOB Merez. In Afghanistan, I was with, in Zormat in Afghanistan, I was with a cavalry troop. I think a lot of people were not viewing this war primarily from the perspective of those people who didn't ask for it and had to endure it. And, you know, in retrospect, that is what I think the starkest contrast was, the stories that didn't get told, that it was so rare that you got, from a journalistic perspective, anyone looking to talk with Iraqis and Afghans about this experience. And then, you know, when I would try and do that, you know, I quickly found, you know, how much I failed at it. And, you know, it took me a while to really get that, like, I'm walking around in body armor. A lot of the times I'm with the military itself, and I'm trying to ask people for their, you know, candid responses, just as a human matter. If this was me, if the United States was under a foreign occupation, I would not be candid with someone like myself. Right. I would not, you know, be willing to trust, possibly with my life, some random journalist who didn't just, you know, show up out of nowhere, but got to go home. And that's something that really sticks with me. The just overwhelming, you know, difficulty, you know, I'll speak for myself. A lot of people, you know, who I have a lot of respect for, who spent, you know, whole years, in Iraq and Afghanistan, I have nothing but regard for them. And I'm not going to, you know, say anything to the contrary, but, you know, speaking for myself, you know, when I would, you know, go for a month and then, you know, leave, and, you know, that would be, you know, for me, a pretty intense month. It took me a while before, you know, I could get out of American exceptionalist mode, regardless of, you know, not realizing that I was in it, and recognizing that, you know, was I really doing anything that was, you know, so much different from conflict tourism? And that made me just, that was hard to deal with, but it was necessary to deal with it, because you have to remember the stakes of this are primarily fought, you know, not by combatants, but by human beings who are, you know, just trying to survive. And I had the eeriest feeling the other day as we were cleaning out a room that my daughter, who's, you know, outgrown her baby room, is going to live in. We were, you know, cleaning out the closet, and I found, like, my old body armor. And, like, she was, you know, playing with the helmet that I used to take out there. And I was just like, I don't want to see you wearing this ever. Like, I don't want to see anyone wearing this stuff.
Yeah. I mean, you know, you're going through the same process as any vet. You know, there's this long period of reflection and soul searching and new epiphanies constantly, even decades or more after you've been there. Right. I mean, it took me 10 years, 15 years to have the kind of epiphanies that I can have now about it and look at things in a different way, which you're of course doing there as well. You know, it's funny. I mentioned to you before this call that I'm a new dad, also, you know, a couple years behind you. And like that question of like my military shit, and I actually got rid of basically all of it preemptively in hopes that, you know, my child would never find it. And even if you tell them it's bad, you know, they could still think, well, this is still cool and something that my dad did and whatever. So it's definitely a lot of complicated feelings around that. So I wanted to have you on to talk about your recent piece covering COVID's impact on veterans in VA care, a really harrowing story that I'm so happy that you did. But I wanted to open up with some of the context. You know, we're recording here on December 7th. Yesterday was a record number of COVID patients admitted to the hospital, with over 101,000 new patients admitted into care. Also hit an all-time high for number of COVID patients in intensive care, for the first time hitting 20,000 COVID patients in the ICU. If you look at this new map, which shows the spread of COVID in all U.S. states, every single state on the map in the continental 48 states is red, the highest it can be for, quote, uncontrolled spread. Meanwhile, Congress is on vacation. There's no new stimulus. In fact, not only is there no new stimulus, but people are about to see the social benefits that they normally get cut. Actually, millions of people are going to have social benefits and social services cut the day after Christmas. A major round of cuts is coming. All of the bills that have been offered are really just lacking any kind of dignity for the people of this country who are going through such a horrific health and economic crisis. But as Congress was deadlocked on COVID relief, You know, they couldn't even agree on a very bad package. Like the things that were proposed were bad. They couldn't even agree on that. They all came together to pass the new Pentagon budget, which was $740 billion. Now, we always hear that the Pentagon budget must pass because it's not just about funding war, it funds our veterans care. And while both political parties view the American people as not needing a handout, which Biden has repeatedly said recently, it's different when it comes to our veterans. There's no question about their care. These military budgets are essential because if you don't pass the military budget, you're leaving our veterans behind. So in the American political system, media, culture, sports, everywhere, you always have to genuflect before the altar of service of American veterans. So, while this country, you know, is abandoning people who are in need because of the COVID crisis and the impact on the economy, it must be taking care of its treasured veterans, right? Well, you would be wrong. In fact, they're arguably worse off based on this really impactful article that you've just written, Spencer, titled Veterans Saw Friends Die from COVID, Then It Got Worse. It takes place in a VA long-term care facility in New Jersey. One of the quotes that really stuck out to me goes, quote, "They were lonely, not being able to see their families. Seeing guys die around them was terrible. You'd be leaving work on Friday, coming back Monday and find guys missing. A lot of guys, you'd think they'd be all right. You'd see them looking weak. They'd stop eating and they'd pass." So Spencer, there are a lot of aspects of the story I want to get into. And of course, talk about some other work that you're doing afterwards. But just to start, you know, how did you come across this story? Who did you talk to? You know, how did you get all the information that ended up producing this article?
So thanks very much also for starting this out by mentioning the concept of providing dignity to people who are going through the crucible of COVID-19. Because one of the threads I wanted to connect in that piece is not just the lack of dignity shown to American veterans, but the lack of dignity shown to the workers at these VA facilities who care for them directly.
Right.
And I don't really think those two things, you know, are unrelated or coincidental. It shows in general the disregard that this country provides for the people who make its economy and its empire run. And early on during COVID, to address your question directly, did a story about, I guess this would have been mid, maybe late March, about the, you know, surely likely impact of the experience of Iraq and Afghanistan veterans who had been exposed to burn pits. You know, for listeners who don't know, I'm sure, you know, probably on this podcast, I don't have to explain that. But, you know, when you would go to Iraq and Afghanistan, large bases, you know, in particular, they would burn everything from office furniture to human waste. Whenever I would go to, you know, a place like Bagram, I would very soon develop what people would call Bagram lung, which was just a hacking, awful, productive cough. And so when I started to talk with veterans who I knew had been exposed to the burn pits about their concerns about COVID, given that, you know, it's a similar, you know, cardiovascular condition, and essentially, you know, service in Iraq and Afghanistan had created a pre-existing respiratory ailment, I quickly learned that even those who had signed up for the Pentagon's burn pit registry hadn't gotten any you know, special or particular instructions for the VA about what their exposure meant. And that opened the floodgates for a lot of other people to come forward. And eventually, you know, many months later, I heard about someone, he's quoted in the piece, his name is Lee Siegfried, who was living in a long-term VA care facility, who had just really gone through hell. And in sniffing around to, you know, some of the other aspects of this facility called Lions, it was pretty clear that the VA had shown a really astonishing, you know, disregard and lackadaisical treatment for those early on in the pandemic in the care facility who were there, and then an insufficient amount of care for both its workers and the veterans it was caring for inside that continues to this day. And now with, you know, the height of the pandemic, thus far being literally right now, some expressed, you know, active concerns about, you know, all of these mistakes, you know, possibly coming back again.
Mm-hmm. Right. And so you talk to patients at this long-term care facility, you talk to workers, several of them anonymously because they were fearing repercussions. And just to start this out, you know, when COVID was first starting, the workers that you talked to, they talked about a lack of readiness, a lack of direction, a lack of information, even things like a lack of PPE and being told to like recycle their PPE equipment, recycle masks and things like that. Talk a little bit about what you learned in regards to the preparedness of this VA care facility.
Yeah, on every single line of operation you can imagine, the VA failed here. It did not sufficiently, you know, create an early lockdown to make sure that the virus, you know, didn't get inside this facility like other facilities, you know, around the country and became a national policy of the VA. The lockdowns would come later and apparently too late. In this case, it did not sufficiently inform either its workers or its veterans about, you know, this is talking about February, March, April. It didn't sufficiently inform workers and veterans early in the pandemic about what exposure might mean, how COVID was transmitted, and the risks of a facility like this getting COVID inside, particularly a place like with a lot of long-term care facilities. There are a lot of elderly people and a lot of people with very serious pre-existing ailments. And then, you know, for workers directly, it took months, and the VA disputes this, but, you know, I have this from enough workers who are, you know, directly experiencing this to find it credible. It didn't sufficiently provide them with the material requirements they needed to keep themselves healthy, let alone the people in their charges healthy. They were recycling, they were told to recycle I think it was J95 masks. I forget what kind of respirator it is, but either way, what they did get issued, they were told to share. One person who believes they came down with the coronavirus told me that even after they returned to work from it, they were still recycling their own masks.
You mean, and by recycling, you mean sharing masks with other people?
Yeah, I mean recycling in a literal sense. It would be like if I, you know, I'm using, you know, mask number one today, and when I'm done with my shift, when I clock out, I put mask number one back and, you know, let people know that it's available for their use tomorrow on whatever rotation they're using.
So it's not even that you're recycling your own mask made to use the same, you know, worn out mask the entire time. You're actually using other people's masks and others are using your mask, even people who had tested positive for COVID.
Yes. And the VA gave me the most amazing like catch 22 answer for that, which was not just to deny it. They eventually did deny it when I, you know, pressed them on it.
Right.
But at first they said that that couldn't happen because that would be against CDC guidelines. And with CDC guidelines. So look, it's not in the regs. So we obviously aren't doing it. Right.
Right. And you know, I think, that approach resulted in, the deaths of 47 people in that single facility. That includes both patients, veterans, and also some workers passed from COVID as well. And this is a relatively smaller facility, correct? I mean, it's not like, you know, we're talking about 47 out of a relatively small number.
Something like 120 people, I believe, are still there. So
yeah.
What happens next is also a really kind of agonizing aspect of this. They, like other facilities, go into a total lockdown,
mm-hmm.
and that creates what people describe to me as a really punishing sense of isolation from
right.
the people who are still inside. And, you know, you can argue that there are, you know, important, you know, particularly, you know, around like May, when the country seems to decide that it's sick of, you know, staying inside for COVID, that it has some public health benefit to it. I don't want to minimize that, but the psychological impact of what it's like to have to stay in this place where you have watched your friends die, not move around, and then have all of the other services that you might need, to include, you know, regular physician visits, you know, being able to have the kind of physical therapy that veterans in long-term care are likely to need. All of that just goes away and no one talks about it. And for me, you know, one of the things that we need to bear witness to at this really agonizing moment in our history is not just the numbers and the policies, but also the real lived human experience of this ongoing nightmare. And hearing people, frankly, cry to me on the phone about how lonely they were, about how painful it was to walk by the rooms of friends of theirs who, you know, toward, you know, the ends of their lives, they were only able to, you know, occasionally wave across a hallway at, was really something that affected me quite deeply. And I hope people read this story and you know, perhaps hear for maybe even the first time about this experience, because it's not just happening in this facility and it's not just happening at VA facilities. It's happening at long-term care, nursing home and hospice cares all over the country. I haven't really talked about this, but I have a family member who has to be a ward of the state. And, you know, I have to hear, you know, as part of Governor Cuomo's executive order, you know, every now and then I'll get calls from her facility to inform me that yet another person who's interacted with that facility has gotten COVID and they're locking down once more and you can't see your loved ones.
That's terrible, Spencer. I'm really sorry to hear that. And to give the listener like more of a sense of what this lockdown looks like in these facilities and in this VA long-term care facility that you studied, the lockdown is basically, you know, everyone has their own room. And for the course of the lockdown, you can't leave your room. I mean, you can kind of maybe step into the hallway, but all of the things that you do, like you said, going to physical therapy, going to other appointments, being able to visit with your friends, going to some kind of socially distanced dining facility. It seems that the restrictions that the VA put on this, probably to try to not implement the most humane or psychologically healthy measures, but taking, you know, once they had screwed up at the beginning, taking maybe an overly drastic action to try to stop the numbers of deaths so it wasn't as embarrassing for the VA leaders and administrators. But basically, they were confined to their rooms and still are to this day confined to their rooms.
It struck me as kind of a microcosm of the circumstance that, you know, we're facing more generally with both COVID and the economy, which is once you give up on the civilized thing to do, all we're doing is calibrating barbarism. Mm. And, you know, hearing people talk about how drastically their worlds had shrunken into such a small enclosed space in what had been, you know, at the very least, a facility where, you know, you live, you know, semi-communally, was, you know, really quite not just, you know, a heartbreaking thing to hear, but a stark contrast with so many of us who have, you know, decided that complying with public health measures represents tyranny because it's the closest thing, you know, they have to actual tyranny to conceptualize.
Yeah. And, you know, for some reason, this one quote in the article, like, hit me harder than the others, because I think it really illustrated the true isolation that they're in. And it's talking about your friend Siegfried. And there's this quote saying his wife sends him care packages and phone calls, but is not allowed to see him in person. And to think that, you know, like remembering anyone who's been on a deployment knows that, you know, care packages are like the thing that you wait for from your family. It's your only connection to the people you love. You're in a terrible place and it means so much to get them and you wait a month or more for them. And then it's a very important thing when they happen. But that's when you're 3,000 miles away on the other side of the world. And it just has this great symbolism, I think, for veterans, care packages from family. Yeah. This is from someone whose wife lives there in the town. And they cannot see each other, even in a socially distanced way, in person. And so Siegfried's wife is like mailing him care packages to try to maintain some kind of connection to him. And so just thinking about that, that existence that he's having to go through and that everyone at this facility is having to go through. As you mentioned, seeing their friends die in this facility, a large number of them, 47 of them, friends and workers that they had befriended. And then you can't even, and any, there's no type of accommodation to be able to see a family member. That really, really struck me.
Yeah, it was heartbreaking to talk, you know, not just to Lee, but to his wife, and hearing, as you mentioned, you know, some of the resonance of, you know, deployment life from, you know, someone who loves someone who lives in this facility, being just, you know, so close theoretically, just being able to see them. And, you know, Lee is someone who, you know, has a pretty, you know, gnarly condition that's, you know, left him in a wheelchair or needs to use a wheelchair most of the time. But he hadn't been inside the facility very long at all. He had gone to stay there in January. So when COVID happens, this is just such an enormous disruption. Wow. And it's just something that, you know, neither he nor his wife expected. They expected to be, you know, not only is this, you know, not something that Lee and his wife expected, it was the opposite of their expectation, that they would go into this facility where Lee, who was a Gulf War veteran, would be treated not just with care, but with dignity and with compassion. And if the pandemic has gotten in the way of that, the response of the pandemic has also demonstrated that.
Right. And, you know, I think a lot of people who aren't in the VA system or aren't familiar with it, you know, the VA is in a lot of ways a service for the poor. It's not just a service for veterans. It's a service for poor veterans. You know, if you can afford the better insurance to be at the better hospitals and better care facilities, or if you can afford the rent at better long-term care facilities, you know, you'll go to them. And the VA, in my experience, is really a resource for veterans on the lower end of the financial spectrum. And so it's a service for the poor. And, you know, to kind of see the management of that, take it, I think that has a lot to do with it. You know, these VA leaders, a lot of those are political appointments, you know, by Donald Trump, who put like this this beer mogul at the head of the VA and all these other people with no experience there. You know, I think maybe if it, you know, it was like a VA system for like the officers who went to West Point, you know, there'd be a lot different treatment than we're seeing now. One of the interesting things is that we mentioned that this lockdown is still going on. Even though there hasn't been a new COVID positive test for a resident or for a staff member, yet the lockdown's still going on.
That's right. This is now part of a broader national VA policy of these lockdowns in these long-term care facilities. And again, you can probably make a case about, at this point, you know, the unfortunate necessity of having to have those lockdowns in place, particularly after, you know, the original mistake of letting it run rampant inside. But the human impact on it is so severe. And, you know, as you're leading to, if like David Petraeus or Jim Mattis had to go through this, it would change in an instant. Like, this wouldn't be something that the country would permit. But, you know, it doesn't view, you know, E4s the same as it views, you know, four-star generals. And, you know, this is something that really speaks to, you know, how just deeply, profoundly broken the United States has become in 2020.
That's right. And so you're saying that this is probably not an aberration at all. I mean, you looked at one long-term care facility, but this is a national, that's all the VA long-term care facilities got the same overall direction from the national VA leadership. They're all under the same national guidance of the VA now with its lockdown measures. So what you saw at this one facility is most likely the case at them all over the country.
I would expect that to be the case. A couple Weeks ago, I saw the VA started relaxing some restrictions to try and allow for greater, I don't really, you know, I had no indication this actually happened at Lyons, but, you know, on paper, at least, to try and sort of allow for increased, you know, family visits and interactions. I am not sure how long that will last, given, you know, the dramatic spike ahead of, you know, what everyone is expecting is going to be a really agonizing winter.
Right. You know, we're in like our second wave. Some places are in their third wave now, but it seems like the waves are going to keep coming. You know, that stories like this always bring to mind for me this idea that, you know, they clearly don't care about these veterans. The VA system could be doing a lot, although the VA workers are the frontline workers acting very heroically to provide care to veterans who care about their jobs very much. I've had nothing but amazing experience with all of the staff at VA facilities. But the government and the administrators seem that they don't really care. I mean, if they did, like you mentioned, if it was Petraeus or someone going through this, it would change because they know this is happening and aren't doing anything about it, are letting these people just almost exist in like solitary confinement, right? I mean, even if you survive the virus, I mean, it's just really, you know, almost a year now of kind of psychological torture being locked away in this, you know, this facility. Clearly these politicians and whoever, like, they don't really care about the lives of the veterans stuck in this facility. So if they don't care about your life when you get home and need help, they also probably don't care about your life when they're deciding to send you to this or that reckless war. And so I think, of course, it's a lesson people in the military, like looking forward, their future as a veteran, how they're going to be appreciated. If you can see this in your future, you can kind of see it in your present as well. Before we move on from the story, was there anything else you thought was relevant that you wanted to add or something that didn't make it into your article or anything?
Yeah, something that didn't make it in is that there's a very small contingent at this facility of war on terror veterans. Mm. And that made me really shudder because I really doubt that this is going to be the last pandemic of our lifetimes. Mm-hmm. And the majority of people who are at Lyons right now, I believe, are Korea and Vietnam veterans. But we have millions of Iraq and Afghanistan veterans who, as the decades go by, are going to live in places like this.
Right.
And it just gave me, you know, this, you know, feeling of just like, if you'll forgive me, walking past the graveyard, that, you know, this is our future. And if this is what, you know, COVID-19 has looked like in 2020, what's, you know, the next one going to look like, you know, 15, 20, 25 years from now, when the VA is, you know, going to have to deal with, I mean, how many, I should know this offhand, but I don't, but, you know, how many millions of people fought the Iraq and Afghanistan wars?
About 2.2 million.
And is the VA going to be ready for this when this comes around again? So that gave me quite a great deal of pause.
Right. No, especially with the current gutting of the VA, and I'm not sure Biden's going to do much different. But, you know, I really appreciate you doing this story, Spencer. I'm sure it was quite mentally taxing. I mean, you know, talking to families, talking to people who are dealing with it, obviously was quite difficult to do. But it's a story that you would think would be all over the mainstream media. You know, a country that cares so much, treasures its veterans and service members so much. This seems to be really missing from mainstream coverage, corporate cable news, mainstream publications, and so forth. And so I really appreciate that you got the story out there.
Thanks very much. You know, it is probably worth saying that the story kind of got the social media version of thank you for your service. Like, got, you know, a whole bunch of, you know, likes and retweets
right
when I sent it out. And then, you know, by the next day, like, no one was reading it.
Right. You know, it makes me think back to when the VA scandal happened under Obama about the wait lines and all of that stuff. And, you know, that the corporate media made a big spectacle of it. It was a major problem. But it was obvious that the whole reason that they highlighted the story of long wait times and did give a lot of coverage to it, it's because it was all to promote the privatization stuff and just say, well, if there's wait lines that are too long, something has to be done. And then they started passing that Veterans Choice and all of these things to sell out certain parts of the VA to private doctors where the care is worse and the veterans don't like it as much and all of that stuff. And so, you know, this story has been buried because there's no political use for it right now. And I think that's also an important lesson for people about the side that the mainstream media is on. You know, they will use veterans as political tools when they need them for something particular, whether it's, you know, something that you know, can hurt this or that politician, if they say something bad about veterans, or something that can push some larger corporatist policy. I wanted to change gears to talk about your book because, you know, having been to these other countries, right? Like I was not in Afghanistan, I was in Iraq, but I still got awarded the Global War on Terrorism Medal for service in Iraq, in the invasion of Iraq, actually. You know, just for the first year, we still got the Global War on Terror Medal. Your new book called Reign of Terror, which I'll ask you later how people can get it, but you can pre-order it now. You know, it covers a lot of things in relation to the war on terror. And one thing that I found particularly interesting in the description is the concept of the normalization of the war on terror. And this really kind of came to mind a lot during the presidential election and the primary, right? You know, someone like Tulsi Gabbard was considered an anti-war candidate, the anti-war candidate, despite being very openly a hawk in the war on terror. There was like this difference between being for war and being for the war on terror. You know, even someone like Bernie, who was arguably the more anti-war candidate, who talked about cooperation and peaceful negotiations with other nations, saying that we could not have wars with other nations. We don't solve problems with other nations by fighting. We do it by dialogue. You know, but he still, you know, has blind spots when it comes to the war on terror. Trump, similarly, considered an anti-war candidate when he was running and considered an anti-war president for this or that thing that people like to pick out, even though he vastly escalated drone strikes and all these things in the war on terror. So talk about this aspect of your book and the idea that the war on terror has kind of taken on a different meaning, you know, separate from conventional war. And for these politicians I mentioned, for others, like anti-war really means anti-conventional war between countries, but the war on terror accepted as just a forever necessity.
Right. So I think the first thing we have to do when addressing that question, and I thank you for it, is define what we mean by the war on terror. So the war on terror, as I'm going to be portraying it, and I believe is the reality, isn't something that just happens in Iraq, Afghanistan, Pakistan, Yemen, Somalia, Syria, Niger. It's something that happens inside the United States. It's the construction, institutionalization, and maintenance of suspicionless surveillance at a scale unimaginable a generation earlier. It's indefinite detention without charge. It's the remote assassination of foreigners, and then eventually with Anwar al-Awlaki, American citizens, his son as well, his 16-year-old son. It's the law enforcement infiltration of communities, businesses, even houses of worship in American Muslim communities to coercively generate informants. It's expansive categories of criminal association. It's the treatment of immigration as a national security threat. And importantly, it's also a public wealth transfer to the military and associated security services that now we estimated over $6 trillion. It's incommunicado detention. It's torture. It's the routinization of official euphemisms and outright lies about who the war targets, the scale of its operations, their second order impacts, and their prospects for success. And all of it occurs in an atmosphere of paranoia that lends itself to the kinds of conspiracy theories that we see. It's the institutionalization, without even necessarily realizing it, of fake news. Think about how assiduously you were told throughout the past generation that, you know, first in Iraq, that success is just another, you know, 6 months away, you know, the next 6 months will be crucial. You know, how long we have been told the Afghanistan war is in a situation of stalemate rather than, you know, saying that for the past, you know, 10 years or longer, our leaders knew that we had lost this war and there was not going to be a way out of it. It was the CIA saying that enhanced interrogation is not torture, that targeted killing isn't often anonymous assassination. Where I'm going with this is, you know, as you mentioned, you know, how normalization of this sort of thing advances. Really, everything that characterizes to me, you know, America under Donald Trump has substantial roots in this background of American life that we've experienced for the last nearly 20 years. And with the exception of people like yourself, who have direct experience, this extremely tiny minority, who have some ground truth, or at least, you know, their own soda straw ground truth about those wars. These wars occur as media events. Most of us can turn them off as we feel like it. When it stops feeling good, we can just pretend it's not happening. Three successive administrations have done this. Three successive administrations now with Trump have simply passed this on to their successors. And, you know, for a lot of policymakers, you know, if the forever isn't exactly the point, to paraphrase my friend Adam Serwer's indelible line, the cruelty is the point, it's at least something that's, you know, convivial to a broader architecture of American hegemony, permanent military bases around the world. And eventually we have just fundamentally blurred the distinction between war and peace, while simultaneously cultivating, and this has been, you know, in the body politic, you know, since the war on terror began, it is not something that began with MAGA, that lends itself to a really atavistic nativism that creates and demands an appetite for increasing brutality, often out of, you know, any kind of, you know, proportion or interest in quote unquote winning the war. You know, for a lot of people, what it means to fight this war, and Trump is definitely one of them, is, as he put it, bombing the shit out of people. And, you know, we're recording this on a day when the Brown University Cost of War Project released an analysis that showed that Trump had, through his intensified aerial bombardment of Afghanistan, increased civilian casualties in Afghanistan by 330%. So what I'm really trying to do in this book of mine is demonstrate, and do so in a narrative and hopefully organic way, that everything people find detestable, one might even say deplorable, about Donald Trump and his treatment of America has real and has overwhelming roots in 9/11, in the response to 9/11, in the war on terror, and in the politics of the war on terror. And then accordingly, to show the wages of complicity with the war on terror, particularly by Democrats, by Democratic politicians who should have, and in some cases do know better, to show the constituencies for maintaining this war beyond any realistic, you know, prospect for a success or even, you know, mitigation inside the senior levels of the military and in the intelligence establishments, who act shocked when suddenly people who believe what their leaders have been telling them about a marauding civilizational menace comes to power and then discredits the architects and contractors and maintainers of the war on terror within the security services by pointing out that we shouldn't listen to them because they're the ones who got us into these wars and they can't either win or get us out. One of the things that I talk about in the book is this condition that sits extremely badly with American exceptionalism. And that's the condition that the war on terror has brought us, being at neither peace nor victory. Millions of Americans who have been taught, you know, especially, you know, those of us, you know, who I take it we're around the same age, I'm 40 years old, for whom, you know, global dominance you know, seems, or at least it used to, as inevitable as the weather, have really a hard time understanding how it can be that America can experience for such a prolonged period neither peace nor victory. And one answer to that circumstance is going to be the one that Trump has provided, that this is the fault of sybaritic elites, incompetent elites, and traitorous elites who are not willing to provide the necessary amounts of violence against, you know, not, you know, this, you know, or that terrorist network, but against Muslims who are not willing to deport millions of people from this country and make it harder for others to get into this country. It's going to be an engine of brutality. And we talk so much, and rightly so, and very belatedly, about what the war costs us. But we talk that kind of actuarial talk, never about what the war has cost American democracy, what its domestic costs are, what its costs are for real, actual people, and what it will mean for the continued erosion of the American Republic. And it's important to remember, you know, when looking back through history, you know, the Peloponnesian War, you know, decimates Athenian democracy, right? The cost of literally hundreds of years of war on pursued by the Roman Republic in very material ways is what, you know, sets off the 100-year, you know, decline and fall of the Roman Republic. And we should not believe that this is something incapable of happening here. And I think that's where American exceptionalism creates this, you know, veil of patriotic unreality. This isn't just a theoretical thing that can happen here. It's an actual thing that has been happening here.
Well, that's a great way to put it. And I really appreciate the message of that book and the work that you've done to make that argument. I hope people buy it, pre-order it. I'm going to as well. But I really appreciate that the conclusion you came to in regards to what fueled Trump coming to power, because others have take the beginning point that you have taken, that it's the impact of the war on terror, the permanent war, the permanent state of limbo, the permanent stalemate. We have not won these wars, you know, Afghanistan essentially being a, for the past 10 years, a very slow motion retreat from when they decided, oh, we can't win this war, instead of just leaving, just slowly reducing or increasing the number of troops over many, many years. But I think some have misconstrued that as, well, Trump came in because he campaigned on ending the war. So, you know, of course, the thing that everyone agreed with, as you mentioned about this is the fault of the elites and whatever, all of that resonating with people. But there is also the argument that it, what resonated is ending the wars and that we're going to get out of Afghanistan. Iraq was a mistake. And he gets his credit, you know, saying that the people supported him and he came into power because of a desire for the wars to end. But I don't really remember that about Trump campaigning. I remember Trump campaigning on violence and brutality, saying he was going to destroy ISIS using the most brutal methods possible, campaigning, talking about why we need to bring back torture, that it was a mistake to step away from torture. In one interview, talking about the need to behead detainees, just as ISIS beheads detainees, to use this match the same level of terror and brutality. Of course, always evoking General Pershing, you know, who you know, famously executed Moro liberation fighters with bullets dipped in pig's blood and burying their bodies with pig carcasses, saying that's how you deal with radical Islamic terrorism. You know, the massive Trump rallies, you know, chanting USA as a slogan. It was this mass movement around, you know, jingoism and militarism and violence. And I think that actually gets misunderstood by a lot of people, that it wasn't Trump's campaigning on we're going to end the wars. It was Trump campaigning on we are finally going to win the wars because I'm going to do what everyone else before me has been scared to do, and that's use the violence that's necessary.
It's entirely forgotten, but in 2019, like Trump actually, I'm sorry, in 2018, Trump actually says that we won the war in Syria.
Right.
And yet, like, no, like, you know, he, you know, bivouacs troops in Syria to an eastern Syrian oil field. You know, that's also something that I really remember talking about, you know, taking the oil as a kind of substitute for actual, you know, victory, plunder, imperial tribute, you might say.
Right.
And, you know, people talk a lot about how, you know, Trump, you know, I think the kind of, you know, glib way of putting it is, you know, Trump says the quiet part loud. Well, Trump definitely articulated the subtext of the war on terror that was always there.
Right.
That this is an imperial crusade
right.
against subhuman monsters. And you cannot tell the difference between who's a civilian and who's a combatant because they're all waging a quote-unquote civilizational jihad. Meanwhile, you see an overwhelming, over the same period of time, government, law enforcement, and intelligence disregard for the oldest, most virulent, most American, and most deadly form of terrorism there is, which is white supremacist terrorism. So the war on terror is also a statement, as is the term itself, radical Islamic terrorism, about whose terrorism matters and whose terrorism doesn't.
Right.
Trump owes his anti-war reputation, such as it is, to people who listen to what he says and don't watch what he does.
Right.
And this is definitely not, I mean, like, that's his whole career, right?
Right.
Like, he's a con man. He's, I think, to put it in a little bit, like, highfalutin, like, theoretical, you know, terminology, Trump is someone who has always recognized the power of media to manipulate reality. Mm-hmm. His businesses depend on that. His political career depends on that. And a whole lot of people were not watching for the okey-doke, so to speak.
That's right. And you have, you know, his opponents who look at what he says and not what he does. You have followers or people who say they're not supporters, but appreciate this or that anti-war policy. But the stuff that really gets the headlines is not this Brown University Cost of War Project study that you referenced, where it showed in 2019, the most number of civilians had been killed by U.S. forces than any year of the war. Any year since, I mean, this is including the bombing of Afghanistan in retaliation to 9/11 and the invasion of the country or in the early years. More civilians now dead in a single year than any prior in the war. But the stories in the mainstream media is about how Trump is withdrawing from Afghanistan and how terrible that he's ending the Afghanistan war and abandoning our Afghan partners. You know, similarly, it's been frustrating with this Somalia story, saying, oh, you know, Trump is pulling out of Somalia and is going to abandon our allies there and whatever, you know, not the fact that the troops aren't coming home. They're going to Djibouti. They're going to Kenya. They're just going next door to do the same exact operations in Somalia. Mind you, operations that have increased terrorism in Somalia. Since U.S. forces have been there fighting terrorism, it's only allowed forces conducting terrorist acts to recruit more people, to justify their existence, to say, look, there's American soldiers here killing us. We have to fight back. And so forth. And so it all, it gets twisted from many sides. But, you know, looking at things now, I mean, the mood in the media, the mood in the public is, well, everything's better now that Trump's going to be out. But from what you're saying, that the war on terror and what your book is covering is has had such an impact psychologically, culturally, our society is just now kind of built around it. And that produced a number of people who voted for someone who talked, who spoke with such a brutality and racism towards Muslims and peoples of the Middle East. Biden's victory doesn't mean, oh, well, people realize that was bad and now support this candidate who says we all need to come together. That is still, all of the things you detail in terms of the impact of the war on terror, that's still very much there. Do you agree?
I agree 100%. And one of the central points the book makes, particularly in its middle section, is its treatment about how Barack Obama very tragically created a liberal legacy for the war on terror. And then when you see, you know, Trump in power, someone who's determined to dominate the broad institutional machinery of the state and does that by, you know, saying that it and not himself, is bloodthirsty and it's incompetent. You get this reaction from you know, people in the media, from security veterans, and just sort of in general from liberals, people who identify with that machinery. And they want to view Trump as a deviation from American history. They want to view him as someone who's just incapable of acting in the national interest. Well, if Trump is, you know, vocally, you know, speaking to, you know, this, you know, anger out there at the war, you know, they can, you know, just sort of use Trump's, you know, rejections of the Council of, you know, generals, diplomats, intelligence officials, you know, on down the line to kind of demonstrate, you know, that point without, you know, pausing to consider the merits of continuing, you know, these wars. And that becomes even starker when you remember that, like, it's been a very long time since anyone of any political stature was willing to say, you know, that these wars are, you know, great and valorous and necessary. You know, the elites really have long stopped believing in these wars. They just figure that they can, you know, manage quagmire in such a way that it has, you know, minimal, you know, material and political impact. And, you know, that's a very dangerous thing because, you know, what my book will, you know, hopefully demonstrate is, you know, in addition to all of the carnage that, you know, and immiseration that the wars produce, they also are the necessary soil to breed more and worse demagogues.
That's right. And of course, with Biden coming in, starting his administration in the midst of a very serious crisis, not just of foreign policy, which are going to be major things that are still going to exist, but the economy headed in a very bad direction, the health crisis. You know, if you can't offer major things to people, that even more sets the stage for the demagoguery to win again. I mean, Trump possibly winning again in 2024. Or a similar type, like Tom Cotton type of figure coming in, and so the, of course, not being out of the woods. If we could, you know, you mentioned that, you know, this the concept that terrorism only matters if it's by certain types of people. That the real terrorist threat in the United States being white supremacist terror. You know, I feel as an activist, someone you know who's gone to demonstrations against right wing groups and anti-immigrant militias and stuff for many, many years, never having to worry about being killed at one of those actions. Of course, the past 4 years, that's very much a concern. People have been killed at them and so forth. But you have a new article that just dropped, I think, yesterday called When Bombs Go Off, the Blood is on Mike Flynn's Hands. It covers how General Flynn, recently pardoned by Trump, is like calling for Trump to declare martial law and have another election. You know, he's not the only general. This guy, Thomas McInerney, a retired three-star general, who's kind of put out this fake story about a special forces raid to capture a CIA server that has like different vote tallies on it or something like that. Of course, Trump's not going to declare martial law. Or if he does, I don't think the military would go along with it. The military command would go along with it. But there is a danger into this kind of language. I mean, Michael Flynn being someone tapped into the QAnon movement, you know, so not Trump, or I'm sorry, Flynn saying these things about how this is what needs to happen, this was a stolen election, doesn't mean that Trump's going to declare martial law. But when Trump doesn't declare martial law and Biden is going to take office and there's this massive group of people who fit in, I think, to a large part, the effect of what you talked about in your book, you know, people produced by the war on terror, now seeing this conspiracy of a stolen election and all of this stuff, you know, is there a real danger of Flynn saying this type of thing? And all of these kind of factors coming together, that the Trump movement and the violence that they celebrate, and this the kind of infiltration out of this like conspiracy culture with high level people like generals in the military telling these people, this group of people, that look, you know, we need to fight to save our democracy and all of that stuff.
Yeah, I think that, you know, it really says so much about America and so much about the habits of mind of the war on terror that like Mike Flynn the intelligence chief of JSOC right. is now functionally a jihadi.
Right.
Like, you know, as we heard, you know, so often about people treated, you know, depicted as subhuman, you know, it only takes, you know, one psycho to go do something. They only have to be lucky once. Well, we have, you know, someone who has as much of a claim as anyone and more of a claim than most in Mike Flynn to have fought, you know, the war on terror the most, who is basically saying that, like, American democracy is done, that the Constitution can be put aside. You know, we have to burn the Constitution in order to save it. All of this in service of a fiction that Trump has, in fact, secretly won the election. And the erosion of reality that, you know, certainly predates the war on terror, but the war on terror supercharges, rolls downhill and goes off whatever guardrails surround it until you have Flynn, you know, putting forward, once he gets into tremendous legal jeopardy of his own making, this revenge fantasy whereby the enemies of Trump are the enemies of the nation, are the enemies of the Constitution, and are not fundamentally politically legitimate. And he's talking about, you know, the 80-odd million Americans who didn't vote for Trump, who voted against Trump. And when you have someone who wore the nation's uniform like that, saying things like that, you're in just such a constitutionally dangerous place. You know, a lot of people were, you know, debating, you know, whether, you know, Trump is, you know, executing a coup or not. The conversation is reductive, but it speaks to, you know, a real anxiety. And with, you know, Flynn saying stuff like this, you know, I go back, you know, to the Roman Republic. You know, Trump may not be Caesar, but he might be Sulla. He might be Cinna, right? Like, we shouldn't believe that the war on terror has reached its final form. Right. What it can do to American democracy, it can still do. And people like Flynn, you know, are playing a role that, you know, can within the course of however many years, you know, be looked back upon as a precedent, as yet another instrument of normalization for things that, you know, America thought was impossible. And I, you know, argue in this book that it is just, you know, testament to the potent vapors of the drug that is American exceptionalism that America believed it could destabilize so much of the world and in the process not destabilize itself.
Right. Well, the war on terror is something that definitely could completely be ended all over the world. And it would not only be much better for the people in the countries who live with the effects of it, for our own souls here in the society that we live in that's so much impacted it by it. But of course, it would also reduce the risk of terrorist attacks against Americans. Spencer, before we go, we really appreciate you being here with us. How can people get your book and find your work?
Thank you so much. I think your podcast is very important, and I really appreciate you having me on to talk with you. You can, I guess I kind of have to say this, there's an Amazon page for the book, Reign of Terror, where you can pre-order it. If you Google Reign of Terror in my name and Viking or its parent company, Penguin Random House, you should be able to find a website that will give you a portal to pre-order it from the bookseller of your choice. I think it's great to support independent bookstores and booksellers rather than anti-worker monopolies. So I would encourage you to do that if you like. But, you know, in order to sell this book, I'm afraid I've got to do some business with Amazon. So if you can order it outside of Amazon, I do encourage you to it. And thank you very much for just letting me talk about the book and encourage people to pre-order and buy it.
For sure. Spencer Ackerman, thank you so much for joining us. I hope everyone gets your new book, Reign of Terror. And of course, everyone can read your articles, which come out pretty regularly on the Daily Beast. I'm a big fan of them. Hope others read them as well.
Nice left.